Are you talking about a Prius?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I want to tell you that I'm the very worst guy in the whole wide world for Priuses, but I have an answer for you. I would like very much for you to email me, mark@marksalem.com, and as soon as the show is over, I will email you back and I will tell you where the best Prius guy in the world is here in town. So
Okay.
he reconditions batteries, but he knows Priuses as well as I know Chevrolets and Dodges. So I don't have his information, and part of the reason is I'm talking on my phone, so I can't even get it off my phone. But I'll do my very best to get that to you just as soon as the show is over at noon. But I just can't help you because I don't know the answer.
Okay, what was your email again?
My email is Mark with a K at MarkSalem.com, and Salem is spelled like
Okay.
the cigarette. So Mark with a
Okay.
K, mark@marksalem.com, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Brian, for holding as long as you did. I apologize for the inconvenience, but I promised to give you the service I did. You'll have the information. Well, I'll have your email when I get when I quit the show, and I'll send you that information immediately. So thank you very much. When it comes to cars, one of the things that I deal with all the time is issues with respect to expectations and results. And there's some responsibility to be shared by both of us, both the shop and the customer. I'll tell you what the shop does bad. The shop doesn't take enough time to talk to the customer and ask questions, especially someone who's qualified to ask questions. So under the best of conditions, you're talking to a service writer that's been there and done that. And when you say that the car doesn't start, then the question is do you mean it cranks over but doesn't catch, or does it doesn't crank over at all, so it doesn't go rrr, 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 rrr. Is that what you're saying? Or it goes rrr, 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 but it doesn't start. So that's altogether different. Those two symptoms are different in different parts of the car. For instance, a no crank is going to be a neutral safety switch. It's going to be a bad battery connection in the starter or a solenoid. So the neutral safety switch only lets you start it in park or neutral. And as all of you know, you can't start it in drive or reverse. So then the service writer may say to you, I want you to kind of roughhouse the shifter. So as you roughhouse the shifter, then stop and try to start it. And if nothing happens, then we're good. Then that tells us something. Then after that, the technician gets it and he understands that when you hit the key, nothing happens. So he's likely to do this. He's going to crawl underneath the car with a hammer. Yeah, we use a hammer when we work on your car. And he's going to get his cellmate, so to speak, the guy in the bay next to him. Come on over here, Mark. And he says, and when I tell you, I want you to, well, I'm going to have you hold the key to the start position, and you tell me when you've done that. And then I'm going to bang on the starter with a hammer. So they all coordinate, and he goes, okay, the guy on top. All right, you ready, Mark? Yes, I am. Okay, I'm holding the key to start, and then underneath the car you get, and all of a sudden it starts. So that tells you that it's the starter or the solenoid. So you can do that two or three times. You can take some electrical connections and electrical equipment and attach to the 12 o'clock position of the solenoid, which is battery power. Then the 6 o'clock position is battery power going to the starter. And then the 9 o'clock position is the trigger to start the whole thing open. So he can diagnose it. But on the other hand, it might be a situation where he looks at the mileage of the car, 120,000 miles, 80,000 miles, whatever it is. He looks at the starter and he knows the starter's been in there since day one. So he might say to the service writer, I can probably diagnose this as a starter or a solenoid, but I don't think that's what's in the customer's best interest. So I'm going to give you the labor and the parts for the starter and or the solenoid, but then I'm going to give you the labor and just the whole starter together. And so talk to the customer and see what they want to do. Those are the two options. And here's the price differences. So that's kind of what it's all about. It has to do with communication. The communication at the front counter has to mean something to the technician, but the fact that it doesn't start just doesn't really help us. And so the responsibility of the shop is to get the symptoms and then ask about the symptoms. As you well know, and I got the gun, as you well know, it's different than I hit the key and nothing happens, and I hit the key and it cranks forever, but it doesn't start, it doesn't catch. And so those are the kind of words that we need to use, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. And I want to raise my hand and tell you, we don't do it perfect all the time, and neither does anybody else. Gil, who have we got?
We have Bob.
Bob, good morning. How can I help you?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My daughter has a 99 Isuzu Rodeo six-cylinder, and not every time, but once in a while, the engine will just rev up to about, I mean, this right now, while it's still warm, about 2,500 RPM, and it won't ever come back down. And then next time I'll start it, it idles perfectly.
Okay. So let me get this straight. When you start it up, let's talk about first thing in the morning. And I don't care if you're in Flagstaff or you're in Phoenix. You start it up first time in the morning, and it'll go all the way up to 2,500 RPM, and there's nothing you can do about it. You stab the throttle and stuff like that, and nothing changes. And then when does it come down? Is it a minute it comes down, or is it 5 minutes, or do you shut it off to get it to come down?
Yeah, I wish I could remember, because I just worked on her car, and it did it even in the afternoon after I'd driven it.
Okay.
But I think I turned it back off. I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Let me just explain. Did you just work on it, and is this problem, is it was not existent before you started working on it, and now it is?
No, but that's a good question. No, it was just
well, the reason I ask you that is I wanted to make sure, because if you left the vacuum line disconnected, that explains why we have unmetered air to the engine, and unmetered air affects the idle. And that's kind of what it's all about. That's why I asked you that. I wasn't trying to embarrass you, and I didn't ask you for your last name. And, of course, it's Bob, and it's a generic name, so no one knows. There's an idle air control motor that controls idle. And we control the idle not by fuel delivery, but we control idle by air delivery. So if we squeeze the air off that motor needs to run, it drops the idle down. If we open up this huge port that might be the size of a dime, and we open it up wide open, then it's going to go to high idle like yours does. So the question now is, now, if we have a vacuum line that's off, then that motor can open and close all it's want. But we have unmetered air being delivered to the engine, and the engine can't figure out where that air is coming from. And so it just knows it's going to go to – it sees metered air, and it goes to 2,500. This probably isn't going to be a big deal, and I don't want you to go out and buy an idle air control motor, because this could be a PCV valve line that's come apart or a PCV valve that's gone bad. Again, unmetered air to the engine. This isn't going to be a tough diagnosis, but it could very well be. We plug something in, we replace a line, or we clean something up. It's not uncommon for us to go in and clean up the idle air control motor. We don't like to. My shop doesn't like to do that, and I'll tell you why. Based on the odometer. If the odometer is in the tall 80, 90,000, I really don't want to clean it, because my success rate's 50-50. If I clean it and charge you for cleaning it and it doesn't work, then I feel obligated to replace the new one but not charge you labor, because I've already charged you labor to try to fix it and not fix it. So you have no charge of labor, and you put an idle air control motor in it, give it back to them, everything's fine. But you've really done two jobs for the price of one. So based on the mileage, we like to just go ahead and replace the part. And typically it's not anything like a $1,000 part or anything like that. The part can be $150 to $200, and the labor would probably be that much as well. So it should, and I'm shooting you high numbers. I'm shooting you high numbers so that I don't embarrass myself. So I don't think this is a real big deal to diagnose, but I want you to listen for a hissing noise underneath the hood, okay? Listen for a hissing noise. You take a piece of garden hose, 3 foot, stick it in your ear, and wave it around the engine. And when you get close to that hissing noise, you'll know it. And if you find the hissing noise, and it's a vacuum line or it's something that's broken, there's a port, a plastic port, and the line is hanging there, and half of the plastic port is inside the line, then that's more than likely going to be your problem. So that's the best I can do for you.
Would that
go ahead?
Do that consistently? Instead of just once in a while? I mean, because this doesn't do this every time.
Okay, and that's a great question, but you can only answer it after you fix it. So you can only answer it after you fix it. If you have any other questions, stay right there, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. 0960. I'm Mark Sam, and I apologize for all these technical problems. We'll be back.
Welcome back, everybody.
And let's pull up the clock here, 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. We're having to do it by phone, and so we're doing the very best we can, but you're more than welcome to join us, like Phil has, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. There's a really good shop on 38th Avenue and Indian School that's been around for a very, very long time, 1967. Bob and Ellen own Larry Harker's Automotive and Repair. They've been around a long time. They do really good work. And frankly, Bob's one of the probably five shops in the valley that I will direct people to that have a problem that nobody else can fix. So he's one of those guys, and he has a geographical area that if you're in that area and you've got a problem where every time you honk the horn, the engine dies, then I would refer you to Bob and Ellen at Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And let's go to Phil. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Mark, thanks for taking the call. Appreciate you all the time.
Thank you.
Hey, I've got a 2011 Honda Accord, four-cylinder, and I've had problems for months now. What's happening is I'll go to throttle up gently, and it'll misfire, and then the engine light will come on, and then I'll lose power. And what I've learned to do is quickly bump it into neutral, start the car again, and it resets, and I'll go, and it'll happen again, you know, very frequently. So since it's been doing that, we've replaced the plugs, the fuel injectors, and the coils, and it's still happening now.
Okay. Well, at least we know what it is, don't we?
Yeah. And that was a pretty penny doing all that, but we're back to square one because it happened again yesterday.
Yeah. You know, do you have any idea what the code says?
It'll say, I think most common is misfire in number 3.
Okay.
Maybe other details, but I don't know.
Okay. When we have I'm not going to be able to fix your car based on the information, but if the car was in front of me or any other really good shop, we would simply plug in this very expensive machine that could cost $10,000 or more. And we would plug it in, and we would pull up a screen, and we would monitor the timing, the ignition system, and in some cases, the fuel system. And we can at least look at the injector pulse width. So the question is, if it sets a code, typically the code has to be tracked backwards. So the code means the problem is in Arizona, but we have to find the city, and we have to find the street, and we have to find the zip code, and we have to find the house number. So that's the process. I can't really answer your question with respect to what's wrong with the car. This, as long as it does it as often as you do, and then I can't really explain why you shut the car off and bring it back on and everything's fine for some period of time. But I want you to know that those are not questions that a good shop is going to focus on, because they're going to be answered after the problem is solved. And so, you know, one of the things they'd want to do is drive it around and with a fuel pressure gauge on it to make sure that we maintain fuel pressure. But if we're driving around and all of a sudden the fuel pressure drops from 50 pounds to 9 pounds, and then we turn the key off and we turn it back on, the fuel pressure pops back up to 50, the car takes off, and then in some short period of time, all of a sudden we lose fuel pressure again, then the question then becomes is the relay defective, or is the computer seeing that the engine has shut down, so it shuts the fuel pump off, or is the fuel pump bad, or is the fuel pressure regulator bad? Which, if it opens, it dumps all the fuel, and if it closes, it builds pressure behind it. So you can see how sophisticated all that is to work on a 1 to 10 scale. This is going to be a 5 or a 6. It's not going to be that difficult. But like I said, it just takes knowledge and stuff. What part of town do you live in?
North Phoenix. I'm pretty near, is it the one on Greenway and 40th Street? Probably those folks, Blackwell? Mark, one last note. The computer my mechanic's using did tell us at one point, he showed me, he goes, look, the what did he say? Oh, it looks like that cylinder is asking for more fuel. So is that the level of detail computer that you're referring to, or is it something even that, or is that pretty simple?
starts out, look, it looks like. Here, let me explain what I'm thinking, okay? First of all, if you just had one cylinder, that the coil was bad, the spark plug was bad, the injector was bad, all you would have is a miss. That's it. So you, instead of accelerating and going, it'd go, that would be a miss. So I'm not real worried about a miss because you don't have the symptoms of a miss. And I'm the last thing I'm going to do is start looking at injectors and coils. But if you want to do that, then if possible, switch the coils around. Now, even if, does this have four coils on top of the engine and the valve cover?
Yeah, and we did switch the coils around. That's how he narrowed it down to.
Okay. Well, if the problem moves with the coil and we go from cylinder three misfire to cylinder four misfire and he switched three and four, then yes, but the coil oftentimes is not the problem. There's a little rubber boot on the very bottom of the coil that covers the business end of the coil and the business end of the spark plug. We call that now the wire or the boot.
Uh-huh.
And so that can fire electricity through it. But again, if you want to guess, but here's another thing I don't understand is I don't know how come the motor's dying if all I've got is 25% of the engine that's not participating. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Motor never quits. It just loses power and the engine light comes on, but I can still putt down the road.
It's a situation where one cylinder isn't going to cause that problem. You should be able to get up to 50, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, but it's just going to take you a whole lot longer than if you had all four cylinders hit.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm not saying anything negative towards you, but there's a lot of men and women that try to get in and Google their car repair problem and end up where they're doing what people are guessing. And a lot of times, like you and I are discussing, a lot of times what they're guessing doesn't make sense. And then the other thing I have to say about that is if he was that good working on cars and fixing them over the telephone, like I'm not, because I can't fix your car, then he'd be working for somebody for $100,000 a year. So he wouldn't be home on Saturdays, answering phone calls or answering queries on Google. But I want to tell you, there's just no question Blackwell can fix this. I'm going to tell you that most of us are going to bid this at probably 75 to as much as 250 on finding it. This might be, listen to my words here, might be one of those things that it costs you 150 to find it and $37.50 to fix it. and that happens 15% of the time, where it's a bad connection or it's something that we can, we found it and we fixed it at the same time. But yeah. I would call Blackwell. I would say to Tom, here's my problem. It's got a Honda Accord and this is what's happening. And can you give me a ballpark estimate with respect to the diagnosis? And most of us are going to give you a diagnosis spread because we don't know what the answer is. And so I'm pretty comfortable with the Blackwell's not going to be any less than probably 75 to 100. And I'm pretty comfortable that he's going to find it within $300.
Okay.
That's the best I can offer you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Mark.
Okay. Good luck to you, Phil. Okay, Gil, anybody else?
Hub lines are open.
Yeah. Okay. 602-508-0960. 602-508-0960. Folks, it's really kind of easy to fix a car. We had a car come in the other day and it had a bad pull. And the lady, her husband had been on the internet and they had done a bunch of work on it. This is a true story, by the way. And so it had a bad pull and they had had an alignment done by two other shops. And so it was one of those, and we don't mind these. There's four or five shops. There's 20 shops in town that are really good. There's more than that. So it was kind of like, you're not going to be able to fix it, and we don't want to pay. And the answer and the response was, we're going to bid you at between $75 and $125 to find out what this problem is. And if it is an alignment problem, that'll cover it. Otherwise, we're going to go drive it, and we're going to check some stuff first. So they agreed to that. And they were a first-time customer, and I don't think that they really believed it. So the shop foreman takes it for a ride, and it's got a good pull to it. And so he brings it back in, and He's a 32-year veteran. He wasn't born yesterday. And he doesn't care if it's a Honda, Toyota, a big truck, a small truck. He doesn't care. He knows that the geometry of the front end is what it is. So he swaps the front tires. He takes the driver's side and puts it on the passenger side on the other side, and it goes straight down the road. Now, swapping the front tires is the first thing you do on a pull. That's it. That is just like the first thing you do when you get home is say hello to your wife and maybe give her a kiss. It's just the first thing. So now he sits on the alignment rack, and the alignment's fine. We got a bad tire. It's got a tire pull. He moves that tire to the back, brings the other one to the front. It's just fine. He gives them the keys, and I think they charged him $100. So that's the issue. And, of course, they had spent a whole lot more money than that. 602-508-0960, and we'll be right back. Well, welcome back, everybody. 48 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. And my name's Mark Salem, and we're having technical problems. But I think Gil and I have gone back to the Fred Flintstone days, and we're able to bring a decent show. I'm on a cell phone, and so I'm calling in like you call in at 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Action Auto Repairs up at I-17 in Deer Valley. I've known Tom since 1983. He's a good guy. He's been around a long time. And when I first met him in 1983, he was actually associated with those big box scopes, if you remember those, the big box that was going to tell us how to fix cars and fix your cars without any input from humans. Well, today we know that was half true because it had software that walks you through it, but Tom could make that machine dance. So Action Auto Repair, I-17 in Deer Valley, good guy. He's on the northwest corner. Coy, good morning. How can I help you?
Yes, sir. Good morning to you as well. I've got a pretty simple one, I think. I've got an older Jeep. It's a 1971 CK5 with the V6 Dauntless engine. Everything's original. It's a fuel problem. It's not with the I don't know if it's a fuel pump or not, I better not say that. But it once I get it running, I sometimes have to prime it. Once it's set there for like a week or something, I have a steel pot I stored in out on 40 acres on between Kearney and Florence. And when I do that, sometimes if it's been a while since I started it, it'll just about run the battery down cranking. But I can put a little fuel in, it'll bring it up. So I'm thinking maybe a leak in the fuel line somewhere, but it's not dropping any fuel that I can see. I've looked for that. I can't get down underneath the vehicle like I used to. I'm 74 years old and okay. Bone cancer issues, so I can't really, you know, get down like I used to. But I don't smell any fuel. Any ideas where I might kind of start there? Different than what I've done.
Oh yeah. I do. First of all, you're right. If you had a fuel leak, you'd smell it. There'd be no question. Especially something that was as big as what you're suggesting. I know for certain that the problem is either the accelerator pump in the carburetor or we're leaking the bowl dry, okay? The accelerator pump in the carburetor is a little leather skirt that's a cup, and as it pushes down when you throttle pump it and pump it, it squirts fuel into the engine or into the carburetor. Now, you take the carburetor off. Can you look down the carburetor, down the throat of it?
Yes, I'm not there right now, but I'm en route from Coolidge. I live in Coolidge, and I drive out there. I've got 40 acres.
I want you to get it running, and I want you to go drive it for 15 minutes, okay? Then, and you can take the air filter off, but I don't want you out in the farm fields. I just take the air filter off. And so you're going to drive it around, and then you're going to park it. You're going to shut the key off, and you're going to look down the throat of the carburetor, and you're going to have somebody just pedal it to the floor, and they're going to go, yep, I'm on the floor, yep, I'm on the floor. I don't want them to stab the pedal and fan the pedal, the accelerator pedal. You're looking down the throat of the carburetor, okay? And this is the engine's off, okay? This is after you've driven it a while. We got it all warmed up and stuff. You shut off the key. You pump the throttle. You look down the throat of the carburetor, and there should be a nozzle, and it squirts a small stream of gas into the throat of the carburetor. And the nozzle's likely to be in the top third of the top of the carburetor. You with me so far?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I'm following you.
Okay. Okay. So we're looking to see if the accelerator pump is squirting, okay? Then the next time it won't start, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to take the lid off. You're going to pump the throttle, and I'll bet you the accelerator pump isn't squirting. That's why you're having to prime it. So at this point, then I'm thinking we're draining the fuel out of the carburetor into the engine. And what happens is when the swimming pool drops below a certain amount, then the fuel or the accelerator pump can't pump fuel into the engine. So you say you crank it over, crank it over, and crank it over. What you're doing is refilling the carburetor. Pretty soon it starts back up, or you're priming it and kind of shortcutting that. So the real question is the accelerator pump working hot and cold? Is it working when it's warmed up and running fine? But, of course, we're doing our testing with the engine off and the key in your pocket. And then number two, when it's cold and been sitting, is the accelerator pump working? Now, I know what you're thinking. You're going to go buy a rebuilt carburetor and stick on there. I know what you're thinking. I'm guessing what you're thinking. That's not a good idea because oftentimes if this is an accelerator pump problem, we're talking about $50 to put an accelerator pump in that carburetor.
Okay.
So, and you're down in Coolidge in Florence, yes?
Yes, sir. Yeah. It's a remote. Okay. I'm about 20 miles out of Florence, matter of fact, on the old Florence Kelvin Highway. But that'll help tremendously. I'll do that next time I have my brother or somebody with me out here. I'll have them work with me, and we'll see. Trying to thank you.
Okay.
Making sure it's spraying the fuel down in there. Yeah. And now,
okay.
Your name is Mark, was it? Or
yes, my name is Mark.
Yeah, Mark. I'm sorry, I forget sometimes. Anyway, once I start it, if I put a little fuel in it, have to prime it, it's good the rest of the day. I can let it sit for hours and be down there doing some work out on the land and go back and start it, and it just starts immediately. But
Okay. All right, let me explain that.
Yeah.
We have a little drip in one of the little plugs in the bottom of the bowl, all right? As you drive it in all day long, that thing's dripping a drip every 4 or 5 minutes. And so at nighttime, it drains the bowl completely, but through the day as you drive it, you never experience the problem because the leak isn't big enough and it only raises its ugly head when you let it sit overnight. But the most important part is you need to see that accelerator pump squirt. And that's the reason why I'm having you drive it and I'm having you look after you've driven it and everything is okay. I need you to see what it looks like when it's okay. Then when you crank it over and it doesn't start and normally you put fuel in it, then I want you to pump the accelerator and you'll go, wait a minute, that nozzle's not squirting any gas like it did when I checked the motor was hot. Now, if you want to guess and the accelerator pump isn't working, like I said, if you want to buy a rebuilt carburetor and stick it on there, I think your success rate is 75%.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
And here's, do you have email?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, my email is easy to remember. My name is Mark Salem, like the cigarette. And so my email is mark@marksalem.com. mark@marksalem.com. That's easy. So if you have any questions, let me know. And meanwhile, I got a couple of cowboys down there in Florence and Coolidge, and I'll see if I can find a shop that they like and trust. But I think you and I can fix this. I think once you call, I want you to send me an email and say, I see the nozzle. It squirts fuel. And when it's cold and it's sitting all night, it doesn't squirt. Bingo. We're 9 into 10 steps done.
Yep, that's
okay.
That's what you told me, Mark. Okay, well, I appreciate that. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
Have you a great weekend.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Coy. Tom, I only got 2 minutes. I'm going to take you on the other side of the break, too. But, Tom, let me just greet you and just let me ask you a couple questions. What year, make, and model of car are we talking about?
I got a 2015 Mitsubishi.
Okay. And just quick, what what situation do you have? Is it a vibration or a hard start, or what's going on?
No, it's just a maintenance question about an oil change.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you know what kind of oil you're using? Is it a semi-synthetic or a synthetic or a conventional oil?
Semi-synthetic, which is what the manufacturer recommends. And
okay.
The question is about how often should I change the oil, right? During COVID,
I
don't drive that much, okay?
Okay, All right, I got one question before I take the break, but you stay there because I'm going to talk to you on the other side of the break. How many miles are on the car?
60,000, a little over 60,000.
And how many miles do you drive a year?
It's less than 8,000.
Less than 8,000. Okay, I already have an answer, but I'm going to make you wait because I think I have to ask you a couple more questions, but I can answer your question. I'm an oil expert for both Valvoline and Chevron. I've been to classes. I know how they make oil, and I know all the new oils, and I understand all those questions. So let me put it to you this way. Mark, there's three kinds of oil, conventional, semi-synthetic, and synthetic. Do they have different oil change intervals? Yes, they do. What are they? Well, I'll tell you on the other side of the break because now I'm 20 seconds away from having to say, just I'll be back with you in three or four minutes. Nevertheless, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. My name's Mark Salem. You're listening to KKNT 960, where we broadcast out of Phoenix, and hopefully you can hear us wherever you're at. Well, obviously you can because you're hearing me now. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear anything. So, all righty. Anyway, if you want to call in, we have open lines, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. And Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. You drive 8,000 miles a year, and I think semi-synthetic is the perfect engine oil for you, and I'll tell you why. Conventional oil is good for 3,000 to 5,000 miles. And if you went to conventional oil, you would have two oil changes a year. Now, synthetic oil, which all oils are backward compatible, if you use the synthetic is worth 10,000 to 15,000 miles. And trust me when I tell you, it's capable of handling 10,000 to 15,000. Well, I don't want you to go 10,000 to 15,000 because I need you to come in for an oil change so we can check your tires and your belts and your hoses and your fluids and your spare and all that kind of stuff. So your semi-synthetic is perfect because the semi-synthetic is good from 5,000 to 7,500. So if you're going to cheat by 500 miles, it doesn't bother me at all if you do 8. So again, conventional is 5 to 7. Semi-synthetic is actually semi-synthetic. Conventional is 3 to 5. Semi-synthetic is 5 to 7. And then 7 to, you know, whatever is your sin oil, your synthetics. You only do it once a year. And you should. I would do it in April or May so that you go through the summer with fresh oil and you just change it every April or May. But you got to check it at least once or twice in that period of time. But I think you're using the right oil. But the answer to your question is 8,000 miles on that oil is just fine.
Oh, okay. That sounds good. Because I only put on 2,000 miles since April when I had it last changed.
Okay, then I want you to go 7,000 or 8,000 miles and just continue on.
Okay, sounds good.
I don't want you to go longer than a year, though. Okay, I don't want you to go longer than a year. But I mean, if you're going to miss it 1 month or 2 months, and you're going to go 13 months or 14 months, I don't care about that. But if the 2,000 kind of messes it up, because now you're going to, if you do 2,000 a year, then, and I tell you to change it at 4,000 or 8,000 mile intervals, then that's 4 years. And I don't want to do that for you.
Okay.
So
That sounds good.
You know, I have customers who come in at 5,000 miles with a synthetic oil, and that's just a huge waste of money. If you wanted to do something, go to a conventional oil, change every 3,000 miles, and that's certainly going to be at least one oil change a year for you, and that would be appropriate. If you wanted to, just go to a conventional oil, 3,000 to 5,000 mile intervals.
I think I'm happy with the semi-synthetic, I think.
Okay. All right. I just want to remind you, and I'm just teasing you now, Tom, your engine doesn't know the difference between the very finest oil in the world and the very junkiest oil in the world. It doesn't know the difference. So it's not going to love you more and last longer than anybody else in the neighborhood because you put semi-synthetic or synthetic in it. I have lots of people who have admitted that in so many words, my car's going to love me and last longer because I give it a premium oil and I change it real often. There's no truth in that at all. Your car doesn't have a brain, or at least a brain to know what you're doing to it. It has a brain that runs fuel and spark and timing and stuff like that, but it doesn't know and it doesn't care. The difference between these oils is this. I'll give you a quick example. That conventional oil will hardly pour out of the ground at 25 degrees below, or 25 degrees below zero, okay? A full synthetic pours out of the can at 60 below zero. So there's a difference between those two oils. But we don't care in Arizona when it pours out the can because we're not in Iceland or we're not in the North Pole. On the other end, conventional oil turns to a tar at 260 degrees, semi-synthetic probably goes to 300 degrees, and full synthetic goes to 500 degrees. But I want to tell you something. At 260 degrees, your motor is in dire need of something, and at 270 degrees, 280 degrees, that motor is going to melt down, and it ain't going to go any further. It can't handle 260, 270 degrees. It just can't handle that. Semi-synthetic goes to 500 where the oil turns to a tar, and there's no way in God's green earth your oil is going to test that upper limit because the motor's toast long before that. So the difference in the three oils is on the cold side, how cold can it get and still come out of the can? And on the high side, how hot can it get and stay oil as opposed to turn into a black burnt tar? And that, there you have it. That's the difference between the three. I use a full synthetic in my truck because I drive about 15,000 miles a year. I just had it changed. So I drive it I just do it once a year. And my wife's car, I have a full synthetic in it, but it called for that, and I'm changing her. She's at 12,000 miles a year, and I'm still doing it hers at one-year intervals. So, you know, she could go 15, but I'm cutting her off at 12, and depends on how much she drives. So anyway, you bring up a good point, Tom. Good luck to you, and hopefully you can make the right decision. But I think your semi-synthetic is fine. But I just, if you're going to do 2,000 or 3,000 miles a year, you can go 2 years, but I don't think that's in your best interest. Now, for the rest of you, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. There's going to be a few of you out there that goes, Mark just wants us to come in once a year so he can sell us something. There are people in our industry that have that idea, and those are the ones that are telling you that you have to come in every 6 months for your synthetic oil change, which isn't true. But Mark's not doing that. You can't go 2 years without somebody checking your air filter, checking your belts, your hoses, looking for oil leaks, looking for tire wear, looking for nails in your tires, checking your fluids. Well, you really, that's not in your best interest. And we find lots of major problems during oil changes. We find fuel leaks and oil leaks. The customer had no idea. So that inspection, which is included for free in the oil change, that inspection, so if you're going to go and change your oil twice a year, then you get two inspections, and I'm comfortable with that. But if you're going to go 15,000 miles over 2 years, I don't want to ride with you towards the back third of that time mileage. I'm just kind of scared for you. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Gil, did I hear the gun?
Yes, you did, Mark. Say hello to Sam.
Sam, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Oh, good morning. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
All right. I've got a granddaughter that's got a car. It's a 2006 Nissan Altima, with the four cylinder. She's got inner boots on the front axles. Both of them have been separated or split or whatever in the middle, so she's lost grease. And I'm just going to wonder how much of a job is that for me to tackle? Because I've done rebuilding engines and brakes and all kinds of stuff, so I'm mechanically inclined.
Okay, all right. You're going to have to align it at the end of the day, but you're going to get two reconditioned axles because you probably don't have the tools necessary and to rebuild those axles or put new joints on those axles or to clean them up and fill a new boot with grease and put the boot over the old joint, okay? So those all take specialty tools. When it spins and we blow the boot out, then obviously you know that as it spins, I'll find that word in my head in a minute, as it spins, it throws all of its grease out.
Right.
So you would start by jacking up the front end, taking the front tires off. You're probably going to have to take the lower ball joint apart, and you might have to take the top part of the strut apart. You're going to just get that out of the way. So you're going to pull that off the end of the spline to the axle. Now you got to get the other end of the axle out of the transfer case or the drive axle or drive unit or whatever you want to call it. So people pull on those, but the boot holds everything together. So pulling on it just usually pulls the boot apart, but in your case, you don't have to worry about that because the boot's not good anyway. So sometimes you can just tap those inner ones out. They have a snap ring that the axle snaps into that female splined assembly in the transaxle. Sometimes it takes a lot of muscle to get it out, and sometimes you're going to use some tools that helps you pull it out. Under the very best of conditions, you cannot put anything behind the axle and pry it off the transaxle. You're going to mess up the seal and you might mess up the bushing, and that's a really ugly thing to deal with. So
I think if you use the slide puller, though.
You could use the slide puller.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you're going to get the axles first, and you're going to look at the old or the new ones to see what's on the other end. Okay.
Okay.
So when you get the used or the rebuilt axles, you look at that inner joint, and on the end of it is a round ring and a groove, and it's splined. Well, you know that when you go in there and you push that in, that snap ring, so that round ring is going to expand inside the transaxle and hold that axle in one place.
Right.
So now, when you get these axles, I want you to measure the length and everything 10 times over. I want you to take your micrometer out and measure all the spline. I want you to measure the length of the axle compressed. I want you to do the length of the axle extended. And I want it to match perfectly to the ones you're pulling out. I can't tell you how many times we have just spent an exorbitant amount of time because the axle wasn't the right one. Sometimes it's our fault. Sometimes it's not. So take a good look, take those axles, set them side by side, and make doggone sure that everything about them is the same.
Okay, and you're recommending recondition that's already got the grease, the boots, and all that stuff on it, as opposed to
yes.
the new one that they would have that?
Most auto parts are going to have those reconditioned axles. My fear is you get it apart. I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I have no way of knowing what your skill level is, but I can tell you right now, there's been a lot of my techs that have decided to do that. And they put boots on it, they packed it with grease, and then all of a sudden, 6,000 miles later, we got a joint coming apart. We take it apart, there's metal in the boot, and then we go, whoa, that joint was bad at the beginning, and you missed it. And that's the only reason why this joint came apart is you booted it when it was already lost its polish and was already eating itself from the inside out.
So
that's why I'm saying... Just it's better for you to just get two reconditioned. And I'll tell you what, it's probably cheaper than you think it is. Okay?
Okay. And what about the front struts? Where if I'm going to be there and she's got leaking struts, I could probably just replace those as well. Are those?
You can. You'll have one end off. And of course, you're going to have to line it anyway. So if you do the struts, right. But if the struts aren't leaking oil, and if she doesn't have any scalloping in the front tires, And if the boots are, or the rubber portions of the strut on the top and on the bottom are okay, I'm not quite sure what you're gaining.
Okay, if the shaft on the outside of the strut has residual oil on it, but you don't see any leaking, would that still be a good strut?
Yeah, because we're going to have to oil the seal some way, and so there is always going to be oil up there, but I want to see it coming out of the boot.
Okay, that would be a sure.
Because even the new ones, will have a sheen of oil on the shaft.
Okay.
So it's we're going to have a sheen of oil on there, but we're going to cover it with the hood of the strut. Anyway, well, thank you for that question, Sam, and good luck to you. 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. We have 602-508-0960. Gil, take her away. Well, welcome back, everybody. I don't know what time it is because my clock just decided to be ugly to me, but I'll see what I can do and get. I'm probably going to miss this next break, but you just give me a 30 or something like that if you don't mind.
I'll give
mind.
You a 1 minute. How's that, Mark?
Oh, that'd be fine. Let's let me talk real quick about a really good shop, Action Auto Repair. Tom's been around a long time, I-17. He's done a good job. He's honest. He's dependable. Now, just across the world from him, Auto Dynamics is in Sun City. He's a good guy. He's been around a long time. He knows what he's doing. And Chuck Nide started Auto Dynamics, and I've known Chuck since the late 60s. So these guys are people I know. So Auto Dynamics, he's on the north side of Grand, on just west of 99th Avenue. And you're more than welcome to visit Action at I-17 in Deer Valley or Automotive Dynamics, and it's on the north side of Grand. It's at just west of 99th Avenue in Sun City. Ed, you're up. How can I help you? Ed?
You can hear me? Yes.
Yes, sir.
Quickly, I will ask you my question, and I will hang up and listen to you. I'm in the market for purchasing a SUV. I'm wondering that I'm thinking about six-cylinder full SUV, full-size SUV, VW Atlas. Do you recommend a six-cylinder or four-cylinder on that size car?
When you talk about an SUV, it's because it can go off-road and snow, and it has a variety of environments it can run in. And the fuel economy on those four cylinders and V6s has everything to do with the right foot that's throttling up the engine. So I always say on a sport utility vehicle, I would use the biggest motor available if your intention is to go skiing or be in the snow or to use it off-road other than just driving to the grocery store and back. If you're going to drive back and forth with a sport utility vehicle, then and you're not going to go off-road and you're not going to go in inclement weather, then yes, you just go ahead and get the four-cylinder. But and I also bet you this, that the difference between the four-cylinder in the exact same conditions and the six-cylinder is going to be 1, maybe 2 miles per gallon, maybe. So does that help you?
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right, good luck to you, Ed. David, you're up next. How can I help you?
All right, I have a oil consumption question.
Okay.
I've had GM trucks for the last 30 years, and this latest one, it's a 2017. I've got 100,000 miles on it, and it's the only one that's ever consumed oil. I go through a quart about every 40,000 miles. 30,000 miles, like 30,000.
Okay.
Is that normal?
I'd be real happy with that. I think my diesel's probably a quart low at, 8,000 miles. I'm changing it 10 to 12. I mean, now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You're talking about a quart low means it's at the ad mark. It's not below the ad mark. It's at the ad mark.
Correct.
Okay, because that's the difference between ad and the full is 1 quart. I'm not concerned about that, but if you wanted to find out, I mean, I don't know where the oil's going. I can't tell you that, but I'd sure like to see all 8 spark plugs, and I think you'd be able to tell. But if they're all nice and white and tan, then the question is where the heck is that oil going? And could you ever have black smoke?
Well, my exhaust pipe on coming out is darker, blacker than any truck I've ever had before.
Okay, and I'm not going to go along with that as being anything valid. I've been involved in the Arizona State Emission since whenever they started in the 70s, and a tailpipe color has never been an issue. I've never diagnosed or been concerned about tailpipe cover color. You got a catalytic converter on that truck. We're supposed to consume all the fuel coming out the back. If you don't have any black smoke or blue smoke, and you don't have an engine miss, and all you've got is a quart every 40,000 miles, then again, I'm not concerned about that. You got to have symptoms, so you got a quart every 40,000 miles. Now, let me ask you a question. If you've got a quart every 40,000 miles, are you doing an oil change at 40,000-mile increments?
No, I do it at about 12,000. I do two.
Okay, well, so
12.
Well, how do you get a quart every 40,000 miles then?
Well, I just have to keep, when I check the oil about every month or two, it's a little down. So I add a third of a quart at a time.
Okay, so it's a third of the down between the full and the add?
Over a year and a half, I go through the full quart.
Well, no, but is it a third of a quart below the full or below the add?
Below the full.
Okay, well, I don't think if you were my brother, I would be laughing at him right now, and I would say okay. The ad mark's there for a reason, and it's your motor's not going to love you, and it's you're supposed to run between the ad and the full, and I've seen motors that didn't like the top end of the hash marks, which is a half a quart low. I've seen people that add oil and the motor will stabilize somewhere between the add and the full. And your owner's manual doesn't say that you're supposed to add a third of a quart. It says add oil when it hits the add mark. And so you're using science that I've never seen before. And if this was, pull the spark plugs and see what you got. I mean, if there's nothing leaking on the ground, pull the spark plugs and look and see what you got. But if you wanted to take my grandkids to California and it was sitting a third low, I'd let you take them, especially if you paid their way. But no, I can't agree with your philosophy. I can't. And then you're extrapolating a third of a quart to one quart every 40,000 miles. Those just don't. You don't drive the same every day. So you might go to Tucson. You might go up four wheeling. You might go up to Flagstaff. You have a variety of different ways to do it. So I'm sorry. I can't go along with a quarter every 40,000 miles using the math and the procedures that you're talking about. I'm sorry.
If it's this is holds a lot more oil. I don't know if it's a symptom of the newer trucks. I don't know. It holds eight.
It's not a symptom of anything. You don't have anything. You're coming off the full mark. Every vehicle uses a little bit of oil. We spray oil on the cylinder walls, and then we use the oil scraper ring to take it off. But some of it's still there. I mean, I just don't agree with you. I'm sorry. I just think your reasoning and your extrapolation of a third of a quart translates to a quart every 40,000 miles is a quart. Let's just deal with the end result according to your math. A quart every 40,000 miles is absolutely normal. Okay, I got to move on. Scott, you're up next. How can I help you? Well, welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. Let me tell you about a couple of shops that are on the other side of the world from one another. Kurtz Auto Repair, I-17 and Bell Road, gas, diesel, good guy, knows what he's talking about. He's not going to take advantage of you. He's the kind of guy, he's a little old for this, but you'll get the drift. He's the kind of guy that you hope your daughter brings home. He knows what he's talking about. He's a good guy, and he's the last thing he wants to do is take advantage of you. So he's been on our list for many, many years, I-17 and Bell Road, northeast corner, and he opened his doors in 87, and I met him just shortly after that, so you can be sure. On the other side of the world is Thompson's Auto Repair. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing is the only shop in Mesa that I can say I know will do a good job. He's been around since 1970, and Brian and Thelma come from gas station families, and I've known both of their families since the late 60s and the early 70s. So I can tell you those kids come from good stock, and the guys there were their fathers and the business owners. They were somebody that would be on my list as well. So they're on Main Street just east of Stapley, Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. Scott, you're up next.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Mark, I'm working on a older Chevy pickup, 73 Chevy 350, and I've got a silly question about a PCV valve. How, if I can take that valve and put it up to my ear and rattle it, and I can hear it clicking back and forth, does that mean it's still good?
Yeah, that used to be our level of quality and our quality control check, but really and truly, the PCV valve is positive crankcase ventilator.
Yes.
On one side of that 350, you have a metal line that goes into the air filter. On the other side of that 350, you have a PCV valve that plugs into a rubber grommet.
Sure.
What we're doing is sucking fresh air in through the air filter, and then it's going through the motor, and we're sucking it out the other side. The PCV valve is not even $10. I was of the impression, always have been, that you just replace the PCV valve every other oil change.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot of customers that we do that to on the older model cars, and if they complain, I'll no charge the PCV valve to them.
Okay.
It's no big deal. But the rattle stuff, so let me change the question. Mark, have you ever seen a Chevrolet PCV valve plug solid?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, but the oil was gurgling out of the motor, and it was smoking like a big dog, and we had a lot of other problems than a PCV valve. So, yeah, just for the price of the PCV valve, just replace it. And if your wife gets mad at you, tell her it's cheaper than her, you know, her hair. Okay.
Well, you know, another thing too is that I listen to you often, and if you have a problem with your crank, your ventilation system in your crankcase, you're going to have oil leaking out of valve cover gaskets and whatnot. And seeping, I should say. So I just wanted to make sure that the rattle test, if it worked or not.
Okay, well, let me give you another test, okay? Go to the other side of the engine and pull that pipe out of the valve cover, okay? The motor's running. Take a piece of tissue and put it over the hole in the valve cover.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And if you can see that it's sucking and you can see the center part of that tissue kind of going into the hole, you got no problem. That thing's working just fine. Okay, got to run though, Scott. Great question. Keith, you're up next. How can I help you? Keith?
Okay, looks like Keith dropped, so we'll go to Jim.
Jim, good morning to you. Jim, I'm sorry. Keith must have dropped. I can help you, Jim. What you got?
Yeah, I want to change the coolant on my 2015 E350 Ford van. And
okay.
I noticed the radiator doesn't have a filler neck. And someone told me you fill it through the overflow bottle. Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
I didn't want to drain it, you know, unless I absolutely knew how I was going to refill it. And I've never encountered that. Is that common these days?
Well, doesn't the there's a line off the bottom of the overflow. Where does that go?
Pardon me? I didn't.
There's one and maybe two hoses that come off of the overflow tank.
Uh-huh.
Do you have one or two, or do you know?
Well, I don't have it in front of me. I think there was more than one. It doesn't look like it's just a simple overflow thing like in the past,
okay.
You know, where they just had one thing coming through the top there, and then it would draw that back in, you know, when the engine cooled.
Okay.
So,
well, the overflow, the radiator cap on the radiator pushes, you know, excess into the overflow, and then it sucks it out. But I think on your Ford, you have two lines, and I think one of them is a big line, and I think one of them goes to the cooling system and the radiator. And so I could be wrong, but I'm thinking if you fill the overflow, and you have you should be able to add quite a bit of coolant and water to the overflow, and that will fill up the cooling system. But here's what I will do for you. Can you email me?
The cooling system holds 30 quarts, and this is just that I doubt if that bottle holds 2 quarts. So that's why I was questioning that it would have to fill it rapidly, wouldn't it? Again, the radiator has no filler cap. I've never seen it before.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to do some research because I need to just look at the cooling system chart and find out what it is. I don't have an answer for you. I wish you were there so that we could look at the cooling jug, but overflow just has one line on it, and it goes to the radiator neck where the radiator cap is at. That's all. I think that there's another line off of your jug that goes into the cooling system uninhibited. Otherwise, it just runs. And I think that's how you fill it. But I could be wrong. Email me at mark@marksalem.com. Do it now, and I'll have an answer for you when I get off the air, and then I'll just email you back. Mark with a K at marksalem.com. I'm just going to need to do a little research. What year was that F-350?
2015.
1.5, 2015?
Yeah.
Okay, and does it have a diesel? Does it got the 6.7 or the?
It's a V10. Yeah.
Oh, it's a V10? Okay. Yeah. All right, I'll have an answer for you. Where I can get a hold of you, you email me. So email me when you can, and if you can't do it this afternoon, then just say, I'm the one that got the 2015 F-350 coolant question. How do I fill it? And I'll be able to handle that for you. Thank you, Jim. That's one of those questions I just don't know. I could be right. I could be wrong, but I'd rather be right, and I'll look it up for you. John, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm looking for a transmission shop on my side of town. I'm on 80th Avenue and Indian School Road.
Okay. I don't have one over there. I'm okay. Sorry. There's only
in Mesa, and I was there several years ago, and I had good luck with them. Can you give me their location again?
In Mesa?
I think it was Mesa or Tempe.
Okay. The shop in Tempe has changed hands a couple years ago, and they are not part of my list, and I do not recommend them. The only shop I have that right now that I can recommend without any qualms is Automatic Transmission Exchange, and they're at 40th Street in Washington. 40th Street in Washington, Automatic Transmission Exchange. Phil's been around since 1968. He pretty much knows what he's doing. I just haven't found any other transmission shop that I can trust to send people to because they don't have qualified technicians that are capable of diagnosing the car. That's the problem.
Well, that's good enough. Thanks. I appreciate your help.
Okay. You're welcome, John. Thank you. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Gil, you want me to do it at the 45?
Yes.
Okay, I'll do the 45, 602-508-0960. For those of you that have a car question, you're more than welcome to email me, mark@marksalem.com. My last name is Salem, mark@marksalem.com. If you leave me a phone number, I'd rather call you, and so we can have a discussion, but I'm going to call you from a blocked line for obvious reasons. So sometimes I call and I get the fact that you don't accept block calls, and I'll wait 15 minutes and then I'll call you back, and perhaps you can take that off or you can answer the phone before you dump me. So, and then if I'll email you back, and we'll do it that way. But I do my best to help you out and to answer your questions and give you the best information I can. And that kind of helps me. This is an unusual show, and this is the second or third time that we're going to go into Plan B. It's because we have a technical problem. I'm in Payson right now on my cell phone. I'm looking at the time on my computer screen, and all the technical equipment that we use to produce that show in Phoenix is not working. And actually, it's my side that's the problem, and I can't fix it. So I'm going to have to get with the engineers and figure out what is wrong with my side, and then and we'll go from there. But KKNT had a show before me, and they'll have a show after me, and everything will be fine, and that'll tell me unequivocally, it's my fault. We'll be back. Well, welcome back, everybody. 47 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. Thank you for spending your Saturday with me. Let me tell you what's going on behind the scenes. My phone is blowing up. I obviously, I have call waiting, and I'm not taking calls, but I have a lot of friends who are willing to help me answer your questions, except I can't take their calls right now. But I know that I've asked two different people to contact me via email, and I intend to answer their questions, and Jim is the most recent one. Kevin's back. Kevin, can I help you? Or Keith. I'm sorry. It's Keith. I'm sorry.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking the call. I want to thank you for helping me several weeks ago with my Lexus. Had the low pressure light on, and you told me to lower the pressure in the tires and drive around, and it cured it. So thank you for that.
Okay, I'm not always right, but you made my day because that was at least once I was right, so thank you.
Okay, and my question today is, I have a 2005 Silverado 2500 HD, original owner, so it's a Phoenix car, and my service airbag light came on. I went to YouTube, and it looks like it's real easy to change out the crash sensor, or what you call it. But all the YouTubes advised me to check the junction box, I'll call it, underneath the passenger seat to make sure those connections are good. And I don't have one there. Is there something
okay.
I should be
well,
checking for connections?
Well, you're way off track. Way off track. They're talking about the black box. And they're wanting you to go to the black box, and the black box could be under the dash, but I think on your Silverado, it's underneath the driver's or the passenger seat, and it's covered by carpet, and you have no business touching that, and you're going to be in trouble when you do, and it's a really bad idea to be messing around with that. How many miles are on your truck?
80,000.
Okay. There's a clock spring underneath the steering wheel. We have to maintain connection with the steering wheel as we spin it. So we have one end of this section of wires that is stationary, and the other end is going to spin with the steering wheel. And obviously, we're not making that connection with just wadding up a bunch of wires and letting them go right and left. The clock spring is the most predominant problem, and it's because the airbag module and the computer has lost sight of the airbag. And so I would say 95% of the airbag lights we have, with what you're talking about, is going to be a clock spring. You have to pull the steering wheel off. You have to disconnect the battery. You have to pull the steering wheel off. You'll need a puller to do that. And then you'll have a clock spring in your hand, so you know what it looks like. You might have to take the turn signal switch off, or maybe not. And then you'll replace the clock spring. You can't lose sight of where the steering wheel was at, so you have to mark it exactly how you got it off. And you can't turn the front tires during this whole process. And you can't have the battery connected at all, and you have to get it completely back together before you hook the battery up. So
okay.
If you want to guess, then do a clock spring. But guessing about wiggling connection is ridiculous, and if one of my technicians would start there, I would be really mad at it.
Okay, so that's okay. It's great information. I may take it to a shop. It sounds like it takes some special touch that I may not have.
Well, taking the steering wheel off is real risky, because if you wipe out the turn signal switch, or if you short that clock spring and cause some wires to melt, that harness from down by your toes up the steering column, up to the steering to the horn ring and the clock spring and all that kind of stuff, it can get expensive. So, and if it's contained with that harness, you're in good shape. But if it goes past that harness, you're really in bad shape. So what part of town do you live in?
I'm in North Phoenix, about 7th Street and Thunderbird.
Okay. I would come back down to Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School. I would come down to 25th Street Auto, 25th Street and Indian School, Martin's Auto, 16th Street south of, I think it's Osborne. Martin's Auto, 25th Street Auto, or hold on just a minute, Larry Harker's Auto. all three of those guys could diagnose and then fix it. I'm guarantee you they can do that. Okay?
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Oh, you're welcome. All righty, Kat. Good morning to you. How can I help you?
Good morning. Are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Okay. I have an 09 Nissan Frontier or crew cab type of thing, king cab, whatever you want to call it. Anyway, this happened about 2.5 weeks ago. I'm driving down, and this little light comes on, and it says slip. And I said, what the heck is that? So when I looked it up in my manual, it has something to do with traction, and every once in a while the brake light comes on. But the slip light doesn't stay on, but sometimes it does. Got any thought on that?
Is it a four-wheel drive by chance?
No.
Okay, two-wheel drive.
Yeah.
The red brake light, you said the red brake light comes on too, yes?
Every once in a while, but the slip light that's yellow on the right-hand upper corner comes on, and it'll stay on sometimes for, you know, a long time. And then when I turn the engine off and go, it'll not be on, but then sometimes it'll come on anyhow.
Okay, and it's slip, it's S-L-I-P?
Right.
Okay. I want to tell you something, Kat. This is a terrible show for me because I'm having to admit too many times that I don't know. I've never seen that line, but accompanied with the red brake light, I'm wondering, and I'm guessing out loud here, I'm wondering if we don't have something, we've lost control of one of the sensors in the back end of the car because the car has to know that all the tires are rotating. And so that's what ABS is all about, anti-lock brakes, is when the computer sees that one tire locks up and three are still rolling, then it dumps the pressure from the one that's locked up so that it can start rolling again. Right. I'm thinking the slip might be a situation where it thinks that one of the rear tires is running faster than the other, and it's really not supposed to do that unless you're stuck in the mud. So I can't answer that question for you, but I'm happy to do some research if you want to email me. I'm happy to answer your question. And I've written down that you've got an 09 Frontier with a yellow slip light and a red. Does it say brake or does it say ABS?
It says brake, but it doesn't always come on. The slip light comes on a lot more than that. And I'm thinking if one tire is going faster than the other, wouldn't that kind of twist the truck around or something or make it kind of hard to drive?
Yes, ma'am, except if it's not really happening, but the computer thinks it's happening. So if you're driving down the road and the computer's looking at all the tires and they're doing 55 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden one of them goes to zero, the computer's concerned why one tire's at zero when in reality Kat has no idea what's going on.
So that's fake news all the way around. Okay.
So I'm thinking it's got ABS, so it's going to have sensors all the way around. What I don't understand, and I've never seen before, is this slip light. And I'm quite sure a little bit of research in the library I have will answer that question. So if you'll email me at mark@marksalem.com, my name is Mark Salem, so it's real easy, mark@marksalem.com, give me your phone number or email me. I'll look it up, and I'll answer your question for you.
Okay, just out of curiosity,
okay.
Snow in Payson?
I'm in Payson right now. I usually come up here. I have horses up here, and I came up to feed them today, and I thought I'll just use my studio here in Payson. But it crashed, and so I'm really sorry I wasn't in Tempe.
Yeah, that's okay. I just wanted to know, is there snow there?
Oh, no, there isn't. This morning it was 21 degrees. There was frost on the back of my mules and my horses, but and we had a flurry of snow 3 or 4 days ago, and it was kind of a little small balls of snow, and it didn't stick at all. But not too long before that, we had 2 inches of rain. So we're doing good on water, at least where we're at. But thank you for asking.
Yeah.
And if I can be so bold as to be the Chamber of Commerce of Payson, then it's up to you to decide. Well, Renee and I, 10 years ago, looked at all the different places. We looked at Flagstaff, East and West, North and South, Prescott Valley, Jerome, Camp Verde, Cottonwood, Payson, Heber, Sholo, Pine, Strawberry. We looked at all those places, and a lot of things drove us away from the I-17 corridor, which is accidents, and getting tied up on the I-17 for hours and hours, which happens on Payson as well. We like the 5,000 altitude. We like the possibility of snow, and we like the fact that it's 93 miles from where we live in Tempe. And so we've been up here, and we've never really regretted it. It has some really nice restaurants, and it has a Bash's and a Safeway, and it has a Walmart. And more important to me, it has a doggone Home Depot and three auto parts stores. So my needs were the Home Depot and the auto parts stores, and her needs was a nice restaurant, grocery stores, and then she likes to go to Pine and Strawberry because she likes to go look at all the antiques, the collectibles, and what I call otherwise junk. Nevertheless, you're not going to tell her I called her stuff junk on the radio, because if you do, I'll hunt you down and flatten all your tires. But anyway, that's why we're up in Payson. And then I bring the horses up here in the middle of April and then take them back in the middle of November. But they're still here because I want them here, and it's not been that cold. So that's it. Mark at MarkSalem.com. I appreciate you spending your Saturday with me. I'm sorry for the technical problems. I want to accept full responsibility for that. It has nothing to do with KKNT. They're far more professional than I am, and that's something that Gil and I couldn't fix, although we tried for 20 minutes before the show, and I've done the whole show off my cell phone. So the quality's probably not there, and for that reason, I'm sorry as well. So Mark at MarkSalem.com, Mark at MarkSalem.com. You're welcome to ask me a car question, and if you include your phone number, I probably will call you back. I have real fat fingers, and I really hate to type, to be perfectly honest with you. Thank you. God bless you, and drive safe.